All right, wars of religion. Hey, careful. She set a booby trap for you. Wars of religion. Europe attempted with the emergence of Protestantism. Of course, protesting. That's all the Protestant Reformation was. It was a protest movement in which people of faith were sick and tired of the corruption that was rooted within the Catholic Church. The fact that the church had deviated from Scripture and the doctrine found within. And there were people furious about it. So much so that they broke away from the universal Holy Roman Catholic Church and started essentially their own Reformed faiths. Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, Henry, all from different backgrounds, all started their movements for different reasons, and all of the faiths were slightly different. But if you have your beliefs and I have mine, and neither are willing to compromise, the only outcome is conflict. And again, it's a point that I made last class. If the people in Europe paid attention to their own freaking history, they would have seen, just by looking at the tiny little Swiss Civil War, that killing one another over religion is stupid, futile, because the only way to win is to essentially kill them all. That is the only way to win a war of religion, to kill all of the people who think different than you. But the problem is in doing so, they're going to fight back and they're going to kill you. Fortunately, in Switzerland, the wars were on such small scale, only thousands died. But of course it escalated. There were several wars of religion within the Holy Roman Empire during the reign of Charles V. You had the Protestants going against the Catholics. You had different factions of Catholics going against Catholics. And then, of course, you had the Ottoman Empire, the Muslims invading, all killing one another in the name of God. Hundreds of thousands of people died. And then it escalated in France. But the worst thing happened: religion combined with politics. And you had the Huguenots, the Calvinists, the Protestants, going against the Catholics. Bourbon versus the Guise. And in the end, it reached millions of people dead. The only nation that managed to avoid destruction was England. English, it's funny. If you look throughout Western civilization, the English always managed to do it better than everyone else. Of course, a lot of that has to go to their rulers, and it was ultimately Elizabeth who gets credit for that. She realized that some people in England were Catholics, some people were Protestants, so let's focus on the one thing we have in common: nationalism. She blended the Catholic and the Protestant traditions, and as I said, so that way if you were Catholic and you went to an Anglican Mass, you were absolutely convinced that it was Catholic, and vice versa. But the threats to England came abroad, from abroad. And of course, as we saw at the end of last class, one of the first threats came from her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots, who attempted to push forward her claim as established under the Act of Succession, 1543, signed by Henry VIII, because she was the descendant of Henry's sister Margaret, which made her the heir to Elizabeth. But if you get rid of Elizabeth, then you can get on the throne quick. And she was desperate because she lost her own throne for being a whore, sleeping around. But in the end, she had nowhere else to go. She fled to England. And stupid her! Even though she was literally into the clutches of Elizabeth, decided to stir shit up, tried communicating with the Pope, promised to bring England back to the Catholic fold,
But of course, there was no privacy back then. In order to communicate, you had to send word by letters, and letters could easily be opened up and read. She was caught, found guilty of treason, and she lost her head.
In a brutal way, too. Elizabeth made sure that Mary, Queen of Scots, did not get a clean death. The executioner intentionally did not sharpen his blade.
So the first twig broke her neck, and she was still alive. The second neck started ripping the tendons. And then the third swing, rather, not neck, caused her head to pop off, like popping a pill.
Well, the moment Elizabeth ordered the death of a Catholic queen, other Catholics responded. The first ruler to take up the charge against Elizabeth in England was someone who we've talked about a couple of times in passing. The son of Charles V, the King of Spain, Philip II. Philip was not only the most powerful Catholic monarch on the continent, because he had all of the wealth from the New World. He was not only in one of the most religiously devout countries, thanks to the Reconquista and the Inquisition, getting rid of all the Jews and the Muslims. But if you recall, he also married Elizabeth's half-sister, Mary Tudor. Now, here's the thing. Back then, as it was true in our country, and to a degree it still is true, the law of marriage, the law, not the practice, not the romance, not the love, not any of that stuff, but the law itself, is based on the legal concept of unity. When a man gets married to a woman, they are no longer separate individuals. They become one. They become a couple. And as a result, all of the possessions that they had individually become joined in common. So, all of my wife's shoes will become mine if she predeceases me. If she dies before me, I get her stuff. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with thousands of pairs of shoes, but they will become mine. Just like she will get all of my tools in the garage and in the basement. She doesn't even know how to use them, but they will become hers. Because what's hers is mine. And by the way, the moment that happens, it's for the life of the inheritor. So, in comes King Philip. And he sends word to Elizabeth that she has no legal right to be queen. Because under the concept of unity, when he married Mary, England became his the moment she died. Now the problem was, Elizabeth remembered the crazy Catholic violence of her sister and did not want to see it to reappear in England. So she basically said no. So what does she start doing? She starts meddling. She unleashes privateers, which of course today we call pirates. And she gave them license to capture Spanish ships on the high seas, which of course infuriates Philip, who then begins paying for assassins to try to kill her. Which, of course, infuriates Elizabeth more, who then begins giving money to the Dutch, who start a rebellion against the Spanish. It was back and forth, tit for tat. It got to the point where Philip decided, I am going to use this illegal act to petition the Pope to do something about this queen. So he contacts Sixtus V, my favorite named pope. By the way, I would have loved it even more if there was a Sixtus VI. That would be epic. But no pope has adopted the name Sixtus since Sixtus V. But anyways, Philip contacts Sixtus, and Sixtus says, get rid of her. Get rid of this woman heretic. Conquer England and return it to the church. To which Philip does. That should say Armada. A-R-M-A-D-A. Obviously the placement of the slide is off. Sorry, picture. Once he received the blessings of the Pope to go to war, he went to work. He had 130 ships constructed, put together an invasion force of 25,000 soldiers, and he intended on basically doing a reverse D-Day. He was going to sail into the English Channel. His plans were to destroy the English naval presence and land his army, march to London, and seize the throne. And if he captured Elizabeth, great. But if Elizabeth accidentally died, even better. But an amazing thing happened, which all of the English people perceived as an act of God. Just as the Spanish Armada sails into the English Channel, a violent storm erupted, which the English referred to as the English Wind. And in the chaos, some of the ships began to sink. It's not easy to imagine. You take a wooden box, put a whole bunch of men in it, put it in the middle of the water, and sometimes the waves cause it to go ksh. And if a boat goes ksh, you're dead. On top of that, when the storm hit, the Spanish decided they were going to bunch their ships together and anchor them, tie them together, to kind of join them together to kind of protect them all. Which then the English took advantage of the fact that the English ships were smaller, and they filled many with pitch, set it on fire, and sailed it right at the tied together Spanish ships. Death, destruction, and in the end, over one-third of the ships were sunk. And about 10,000 men lost their lives, shattering Philip's ability to invade England. Now, one of the most amazing aspects of this is you would think that the Catholics in England would have sided with the Catholic Spanish. But that never happened. The English Protestants and Catholics alike joined together as Englishmen. And they decided to resist the Spanish. Religion had nothing to do with it from the English perspective. And in the end, Elizabeth was heralded as having saved England from this Spanish threat, and she was regarded as a national hero, which, as I mentioned a couple of times already, this is one of the reasons why even today the English regard her as one of the most successful monarchs in their entire history. Questions? So unlike the rest of the continent, England dodged a bullet. But, unfortunately, the continent was not paying attention. The continent was not studying history. Because the funny thing about history is it always repeats itself. Always does. Because human beings, by our nature, we are selfish, narcissistic, and dumb. We naively think we can do it better than anybody else, but the problem is we end up doing the same damn things. The 30 Years' War was one of the most violent events in the history of Europe, and it was all because of religion. The funny thing is it should have never escalated to the level that it did. But it escalated because of who was involved. The family of Charles V, the Habsburgs. After dealing with decades of conflict, the exhausted Charles in 1556, after the Peace of Augsburg, decided he was going to retire. And he made a fateful decision. He decided to split his empire into two. To Spain, and I think this is a click, it would, to Spain and its new world empire would go to his son Philip, who we just talked about. Philip would do his kingly duty. He would get married to another woman. He would produce offspring, securing the lineage. As far as Austria and the Holy Roman Empire, which territories all the way down into Italy, well, this would go to his brother, Ferdinand I. But even though the empire was divided into two sections, it's probably obviously or easy to figure out that the Austrian Habsburgs maintained an alliance with the Spanish Habsburgs all the way after the division. Questions. Now, one key thing to remember is both the Spanish and the Austrian Habsburgs were devout Catholics. Now, the person who started the 30 Years' War was the grandson of Ferdinand I, Ferdinand II. In 1619, he was elected to be emperor over the Holy Roman Empire. Now, Ferdinand's education was similar to the education that Catholic kings received at the time. He was educated by the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, the foot soldiers, the defenders of faith. So, as a result, he became very religiously intolerant because he only got the Catholic perspective. Well, in his religious ferocity, he made an alliance of sorts with his cousin. Nephew. Apologize. Philip IV of Spain. Now, one of the dens of the Catholic Counter-Reformation was Spain, because Spain had an industrialized Inquisition session or system. So, to save the Holy Roman Empire from Protestantism, he brought in Spanish inquisitors. And he hoped to use force to purify the empire, to impose a counter-reformation. In essence, to restore the northern part of Germany back to the Catholic world. And it began in one of the kingdoms of the empire. In Bohemia. Now, just to shock your brains a little bit, if you recall, Bohemia was where Jan Hus came from. And during the 15th century, 200 years before, the Catholic Church launched a crusade against the Hussites, and the Hussites managed to beat them back. The same reason why the Bohemians were also one of the few people to actually defeat the Mongolians. Because it's hard to invade. It's a rough region, and these people are military competent. But if you recall, the compromise that came out after the Hussites beat back four crusades was that the Catholic Church allowed them to do their own thing religiously. So the religion of Bohemia, technically it was Catholic, but it was more like a Protestant faith in that there were German Bibles and masses were done not in cathedrals, but in small houses. The people had a say on who their priests were. So it was Catholic, but it really wasn't. Well, another interesting component of the Bohemian society was that they selected, well, the nobles selected, or elected as I have it on there, their king. Nothing different. As I said, it was always the nobles who endorsed the ascension of individuals. But a weird thing happened in 1619 when the Bohemians decide not to elect a Bohemian, because the Bohemian ruling family died without heirs. So they look throughout the family tree and they find a distant relative of their ruling family, Frederick of Palatine. Palatine was a Calvinist country. It was one of the northern German states. So the fact that they're pulling in a Calvinist, you combine Calvinism with the Bohemian version of Catholicism, and it wouldn't be that far-fetched to understand that Bohemia was going to leave the Catholic Church, finally. FYI, Frederick also was the son-in-law of an English king that we're going to talk about today, James I. And the English had been fighting the Spanish since Philip II. So there's politics involved. Well, ironically, when Ferdinand learns of Frederick's election, he encouraged the Catholic nobles to rise up and rebel against the election. In supporting this, he sent in Austrian and Spanish soldiers. And to make matters worse, they brought with them inquisitors. They essentially was going to purify Bohemia from within. But a bizarre thing happened. Most of the peasants wanted Ferdinand. And for all sakes and purposes, they were okay with becoming Protestant. So this was less about, well, I mean, it was in the guise of religion, but it also had an element of class warfare. Because the peasants used it as an opportunity to demand more rights, more economic freedom. But they received no aid from the German Protestant League, nor England. So what you ended up having was a civil war. The majority of the peasants and some of the nobles wanted to go with a Protestant king, and they fought battles with the Catholic nobles, the minority of peasants, supported by Austrian and Spanish troops. In the end, the destruction was beyond imagine. The peasants couldn't resist the Habsburgs, and Bohemia would be completely devastated. 3/4 of the towns, 75%, were leveled. And I'm not talking that they had a couple of buildings blown up. Literally, entire towns were burned to the ground. Fields destroyed, homes destroyed. Almost the entire aristocracy, almost all of the nobles, Catholic and Protestant alike, killed. Total death count? 2.2 million. Well, when news of what took place in Bohemia spread across the continent, there was shock, there was disbelief, there was horror. And in the end, it would trigger an international war. Because if Ferdinand could do this to one of his own kingdoms, what would he do to other states? And what did he want to do? Well, he declared it. In his response, he stated essentially that Bohemia was just the first, but there would be others, because Catholicism was going to be restored, which of course was a direct violation of the Treaty of the Peace of Augsburg that had settled the wars of his great grand uncle. Economic violence, political violence, direct violence, all used for nearly 30 years. It got so bad internally that all of the powers that surrounded the Holy Roman Empire, Denmark, Sweden, France, they all invaded to attempt to put down the Habsburg violence. But nothing could stop the Habsburgs. They fought battle after battle after battle, devastating towns, cities, and most importantly, economic centers. From 1609 all the way up until the 1640s, the Habsburgs enjoyed victory after victory. That was until in 1643, during the reign of Louis XIII, The French got sick of it, and they trick the Spanish into a battle in which they were not prepared for. The Battle of Roncesvalles
in southern France, they managed to wipe out
the Spanish army.
Because the French realized, why am I going to fight the Spanish in Germany? Why don't I send an army and attempt to invade Spain?
Well, with the Spanish knocked out of the war, that left only the Austrians, and it was only a matter of time before the Austrians would themselves be defeated. The Habsburg was beat by a Swedish army at the Battle of Jankau,
up near Prague, right there. There's that dot right there.
Well, as a result of this, Austria couldn't rebuild its army. The German princes all aligned against the emperor. And after the defeat, they forced the emperor's allies to betray the emperor, leaving the emperor alone. But by this point, Ferdinand II was dead, and the ruler was Ferdinand III, his son. But in 1646, after realizing that he was alone, he agreed to establish a peace. And this peace would be the last significant end to a religious war. Because it was after this that the Europeans realized fighting each other in the name of God is stupid. They signed the Treaty of Westphalia. Guess what the Treaty of Westphalia was based on? The same principle that the Peace of Augsburg was based on. Carius Regio, eius religio. Whose rule? His religion. It took them devastation on an unprecedented scale to realize you can't force faith upon people. So, Christians, after this point in the Holy Roman Empire, would be allowed to privately worship their own faith, even if they lived in non-denominational areas. So if you were a Protestant, you lived in a Catholic place, the Catholics weren't allow you to be a Protestant, and vice versa. And you would be allowed to freely move if you wished. But this is what makes this tragic. Less the details of the war, but the consequences of trying to kill another person in the name of God. It is estimated in the 30 years of the war that 30% of the German population died. 7.5 million out of a total population of 21 million. Dead, gone, lost. Now, of course, the truth is that only about 300,000 were killed on the battlefield. But because the devastation took place in the economic centers, because the battles were fought on the fields, what killed the majority of people was the famine that erupted. Because when you don't have food, disease spreads. Plus, to make matters worse, the plague reappeared in the middle of it. 7.5 million. That's the entire population of Massachusetts plus a good chunk of Rhode Island. Just saying. The German economy would be shattered. This is one of the reasons why Germany was not unified until 1871. It remained separate little kingdoms because the economy was so bad they could never join together. It also marked the end of the Spanish as being a power. Spain almost was bankrupted. But most significant, this was the last large-scale religious conflict. This is when the Christians realized there never would again be a universal faith. But that's not to say that war would go away. No. Because the move left religion and started focusing on just power politics. Which is where we're going to go next. Questions?
And there were dark times. Oh. And then there would be light. Because as religion decentralized, de-emphasized, what ended up happening is the thrones, the kings, wanted more, more, more. And the kings wanted to have complete authority within their realms, which would give rise to the modern states that exist in Europe today.
Now, the chapter in the book that discusses this information, I forgot what chapter we're on, but they do talk about a whole bunch of other states. So they do discuss, you know, what was the political state of the Holy Roman Empire. I think there's a unit in there on Russia. We just don't have time to talk about all that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the bookends. The state where the king had the most power as a result of pushing religion aside, and the state where the kings ended up with the least, but religion still would not be an issue. But we're going to begin with England, and we'll let you figure out when we're done which one is this. Is this the most powerful or the least powerful?
All right, decade and a half before the 30 Years' War erupted, but only 15 years after the Spanish Armada, March 24th, 1603, Queen Elizabeth I dies after a 45-year reign.
Now, she was known as the Virgin Queen, as I mentioned before. Was she really a virgin? Don't know. But I do know she never married. And she never married for various reasons. If you look up, you know, historians analyzing why, they'll give you all different kinds of reasons. But at the end of the day, she decided to wed herself to her people. But the problem is in doing so, she didn't produce an heir. So not only did she die husbandless, she also died childless, which now meant there was a vacancy. But, no worries, we've talked about this already. Henry VIII, 4 years before he died, passed the Act of Succession, in which, as we know, he would be succeeded by his son, Edward VI, who died as a child, Mary Tudor, who died childless, and Elizabeth. But the throne was then to pass through the bloodline of his sister Margaret. Now, as I mentioned, Margaret had been sent by her brother to Scotland, where she was married off to James IV. James IV was succeeded by his third son, who would become James V. Bless you. Bless you. But James V's only surviving legitimate heir was Mary, Queen of Scots, who is dead. But if you recall, I did say that when Mary was forced to abdicate, the Scots gave the throne to her one-year-old son, who would become James VI. Which meant we have an adult, male, experienced king who's next in line. So at the age of 37, Parliament invited him to come to England and he would be crowned James I. But he always was the sixth James in Scotland because there was no United Kingdom at the time. These were separate kingdoms. Now here's the thing. As King of Scotland, he established an effective royal government. He was raised by the Scottish nobles who served as regents, and they trained him to actually be an intellectual, a strong, capable monarch. And he maintained relative peace with the Scottish lords, so there was no violence. Ironically, when Elizabeth killed his mother, he bore no animosity towards Elizabeth. In fact, he maintained friendly relations, in spite of the fact that Elizabeth killed his mom. And during the Spanish Armada, he pledged to send Scottish help if Elizabeth asked. So, he was well known within the court of Elizabeth. So, when he came in, he would be crowned king. But ironically, it would be during his reign where the concept of Great Britain would be born. England itself had conquered Ireland, and the English kings had long claimed the title of King of Ireland, Queen of Ireland. They also had conquered the Kingdom of Wales. So the English crown was actually three crowns unified. But now the last kingdom on the island, Scotland, is technically merged together in James. So it would be James who coined the phrase Great Britain, because what he wanted to do is he wanted to rule over a unified state. But, interestingly enough, while Scotland accepted the title, England did not. So, there was one king, but they would maintain separate parliaments. The Scottish Parliament made law for Scotland, and the English Parliament made law for England, Wales, and Ireland. Questions? Please be tomorrow, please be tomorrow, please be tomorrow. All right. Now, Parliament. Parliament, Parliament, Parliament. When James became king, Parliament existed. But the Parliament then was not the Parliament of today. Parliament back then was not a full-blown legislative body. And Parliament did not sit in session every single day of the week. Every single week of the year. Rather, Parliament was only called into session by the king when there was some type of emergency. So, because he had experience, because he was not dumb, during his reign, he tried ruling so efficiently that there never was a need to call Parliament. Because ultimately, he did not want there to be disruption. But he also had a justification. And this would be this book, which he wrote in 1597, The True Law of Free Monarchies, section of which is in the Extra Credit Reader. This book would be read by all of the monarchs in the continent, and they would essentially desire the same thing. In this book, he would establish the ideological base for monarchy. The ideas behind the rule of one person. He sets out with a two-part foundation. The first is biblical. He claims that for biblical reasons, kings are higher than men. A king is higher than a normal man in God's eyes. After all, did not David become king of the Hebrews? And did he not rule with sole authority, with the blessing of God, after he smote Goliath on the battlefield? Well, James says, and I quote, "Kings are called gods by the prophetical King David because they sit upon God's throne." The throne in earth, and have the count of their administration to give unto him. To put it another way, a man can only become king if God wills it. Because after all, God controls everything. So, in this section, he hammers out which today we call divine rights of kings. That essentially a king can do what they want because it's God who wants them there. So in essence, nobody has the right to question a king. Because to question a king, you are questioning God's judgment. And that's not a good thing. So if this guy cannot be questioned, that essentially implies that he has all the power. And that's the second component of the theory of monarchy established by James. That a monarch has absolute authority. That a king can impose laws, that a king can enforce the laws, and the king can serve as judge and pass judgments of those who break the laws. Because again, to question a king is to question God's judgment. But, interestingly enough, this does not mean that a king can be abusive. No, or tyrannical. In his book, James puts a limit on absolutism. He says that rulers must pay attention to tradition and God. So the limits on absolutism, tradition and God. After all, if a king tried putting rules on society that society rejects, that means the king is acting like a tyrant. Or if the king rules in a way that violates scripture, that could result in the damnation of all the souls of his people. So in that sense, a king could be removed. Because after all, if a king violates tradition in God, he is, and I quote, stirring up such scourges as pleaseth God for the punishment of wicked kings. So long as he ruled benevolently, following scripture, in a way that didn't violate the rules of society, a king should be able to rule, absolutely. Questions? So, because he was an effective king, he never felt the reason need to call parliament. Because at the end of the day, he always tried doing what was right. But, truth be told, there would be four times over the course of his reign that he would be forced to call parliament. Ironically, because, going back to the Magna Carta, parliament controls the purse strings, parliament has the right to tax, he was forced to call parliament to deal with the same problem that we're dealing with in our country today. Inflation. Prices were going up, decreasing the purchasing power of the population. Now, of course, James contributed to this, just like our current government has. Because what did James like to do? He liked to spend money. And while he was an effective ruler, he was incompetent, economically speaking. He kept spending and spending and spending, creating unpayable national debt. Just like the Joe Biden administration did, just like the Donald Trump administration was forced to do because of COVID, just like the Obama administration did, just like the George W. Bush administration did. Back when Bill Clinton was president, interestingly enough, he worked with the Republicans, and they passed a balanced budget, where for 2 years, they did not spend more money than they took in. But that was like the only time in my lifetime that it happened. And it was less to do with good on both, but both the Republicans and Bill Clinton were seeking to destroy each other. So they basically decided, let's see if we can work together and come up with a compromise. But George W. Bush was forced to spend after 9/11. And he got us into the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Obama came in, and he was a kind of a socialist, and he just spent, because the United States did go into a slight recession, so he spent his way out of it. Trump came in, he had to spend, because the government shut down everything. So there was all the COVID BS. And then Obama came in, and he's a green new dealer. And he's just spending and spending and spending because he wants to. But the problem is if you look at the national debt clock, I think we're at $33 trillion.
which means that our government in your lifetimes has basically spent so much money that it's not going to be paid off during your lifetime, the lifetime of your kids or grandkids.
And that's why inflation is crazy. And what does the government keep doing? Spending more.
History repeats itself, my friends. Well, how did Parliament deal with inflation? Well, they came in and they just increased taxes, which only compounded things.
Because once taxes were increased and the government took in more money, the king spent more. So economically, not so good. But foreign policy, James was brilliant. James was gifted.
4 significant things happened during his reign. The first, he ended the war with Spain in 1604. And we'll see how he ended up doing it in a minute. He also tried ending the act of privateers. He wanted to end English piracy. He avoided England getting involved in the 30 Years' War. And it was James who signed the charters that resulted in the foundation of Jamestown down in Virginia, named after him, and Plymouth in 1620.
So decent ruler, bad with money, good with foreign policy. But the last little detail that I'm going to give you is he also tried pushing literacy by patronizing literature. So he took the government's money and used it to spread literacy.
It was during his reign that William Shakespeare wrote his great works. When we talk about the scientific revolution, after we come back and take exam number 3, he also, his prime minister, Lord Francis Bacon, would develop the empirical method of science. So he sponsored literacy, he sponsored science. But most importantly, he sponsored one of the most important books in the English language. Shnikes, I thought it was going to come up, I guess not. The King James Bible. The King James Bible.
The King James Bible was first published in 1611.
It was actually the 3rd English translation, the first being Wycliffe's.
But the King James Bible today is the book that contains or addresses all of the spiritual issues of the Anglican Church.
Questions? Unfortunately, in March 1625, James, in failing health, suffered a stroke and died. And he's regarded as a decent king. Unfortunately, the apple fell really far from the tree. And his son, Charles.
Now, of course, one of the most important kingly duties is to produce offspring, and James was successful in that. His firstborn son, Henry, however, died tragically in 1612. But his second son, Charles, managed to survive into adulthood.
Now, Charles, because he was born in 1600, was essentially raised in England. So even though he was of Scottish descent, he never viewed himself as Scottish. He viewed himself as English. But in spite of that, when he became king, the people of England were not too pleased. He was, arguably, one of the most unpopular monarchs in all of English history. Because of shenanigans in which he engaged. He was, in his youth, in many ways, like Henry VIII. He liked to do the things that all men like doing as often as possible, as frequently as possible. He also liked to drink and revel and have fun. But he also was born a prince, so he was a spoiled little brat. In order to solidify his agreement with Spain, James I made a marriage arrangement with King Philip III. James had arranged that Charles would marry Maria Anna. Not Anna Maria, Maria Anna. Because you take a Spanish princess, you merge it together with an English prince, and there will not be war between the two. Well, unfortunately, Charles did something extraordinary. He was not satisfied with this marriage because the only thing he got to see was pictures of her, paintings. So what he decides to do was he snuck out of London, dressed as a commoner, got on board a ship, sailed to Spain, somehow went to the capital, entered the palace, and got all the way into the princess's bedchambers to get a good look at her. And you know what he decided? Paintings lie. He was not impressed. She was not a fiery Spanish princess. The Habsburgs. Habsburgs had a tendency to do inbreeding. So she was not hot.
He was kind of repelled.
Plus, to make matters worse, Spain wanted Charles to convert to Roman Catholicism. And Philip demanded of his future son-in-law that the English crown should push to restore Catholic churches separate from the Anglican churches. Now, Charles wanted nothing to do with Maria Anna, and he wanted nothing to do with this counter-reformation. So, he told Philip to his face, no. And he broke off the arrangement. Ironically, on his way back, he stopped in France. And he somehow made his way to Paris, and he got into the throne of Henri IV, Bourbon, and there he saw Henri's daughter, Henrietta Marie, and he fell in love. Because by all accounts, the picture was worse than her actual looks. The picture could not do justice to her beauty. And he was infatuated. Now, ironically, Henrietta Maria was also a Catholic. And in order to marry a Catholic, you have to become a Catholic. So whereas he was unwilling to convert to Catholicism to marry a Spanish princess, he was more than willing to do so to marry Henrietta Maria. Well, when word spread what he had done, not only did he incite the Spanish, but now he's coming back as the heir to the throne, as a Catholic, married to a Catholic princess. Which means their children are going to be what religion? Catholic. Remember the success of Elizabeth? It was all about no religion. To make matters worse, he constantly butted heads with Parliament. For instance, Charles wanted to join the war, the 30 Years' War, whereas his father didn't want to get involved. Parliament said no, but they did send some funds to help out the Protestants, which of course angered him because he wanted to join with the French. Charles wanted to once again reestablish the use of privateers, pirates, to prey upon Spanish ships. Parliament said no, and only granted limited funding to build new ships, because Parliament didn't want to get into a war with Spain. To make matters worse, he completely bought into the ideology that his father theorized. He believed that God made him king, and that gave him the right to have absolute authority in his realm. He was determined to govern according to his own will. But here is the catch. If you are going to be an absolute monarch, you must have three things. You have to have a standing army. Right? Have you ever heard of a dictator coming to power without an army? You know, it doesn't work. Yeah, like the whole insurrection. Yeah, that was a joke. That was a laugh. Insurrection January 6th. I've never seen an attempted seizure of power without weapons. If you're going to take over government, you need weapons. You need soldiers. And there was none. How do you get soldiers? You needed money. Well, he didn't have much money. Parliament controlled the purse strings. So he couldn't buy an army even if he wanted to get one. And last but not least, there had to be social acceptance. The people had to want it, or at least be okay with it. Doesn't have to be everybody, but it has to be enough. So, think of the dictators of the 20th century. Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini. None of them could have come to power unless the people wanted it. Well, no one in England wanted him to rule with all his authority. So, even though he dreamed of being this powerful ruler, he didn't have the three necessary tools. To make matters worse, he got involved in religion. He began attacking the Calvinists who began to infiltrate the Anglican Church. In particular, he rejected the Calvinist notion of predestination, in which God has already laid out the plan the moment you're out of mom. Instead, he argued the Catholic position. You have free will. You decide your fate, not God. God, however, will punish you if you commit sin. But that's your choice. You can avoid sin by not sinning. And thus, God may give you the gift of ascension in heaven. But again, free will. James believed ultimately that human beings controlled their own fate. Additionally, he favored the Catholic structure of Episcopalianism, where you have the church hierarchy, where there are at the very least bishops who control bishoprics, who oversee the priests, who run the churches, as well as the monks and the nuns. This is a top-down system. Calvinists, on the other hand, as we said, was community-oriented. It was Presbyterian in nature. It was bottom-up, where the people of the community make the rules for the church. Well, here's the thing. You're arguing Catholic free will. You're arguing Catholic Episcopalianism. You're married to a Catholic. Are you trying to impose a counter-reformation? Well, here's the last two clicks of the day. He, acting as he was, would make two critical blunders that would come up and blow up in his face. Blunder number one. He developed an English-style Inquisition. He would take control of an ancient court system known as the Star Chamber. This court was originally designed to kind of be like an appeals court, where if the king learned about judges who went rogue and were not enforcing common law, could basically go into the Star Chamber, and it was called the Star Chamber because the lattice in the room on the ceiling was shaped like a star. So the judge would basically be investigated. Well, James packed the Star Chamber and used it for ideological purposes. And 3 or 4 years into his reign, he began calling in before the Star Chamber Calvinist leaders and accusing them. This led to the second blunder that would blow up in his face. In 1629, Parliament, fed up with his bullying and his behavior, and the Star Chamber began criticizing the king, as was their right in Magna Carta. To make matters worse, the king began trying to raise taxes outside the system. To which Parliament pointed out, you can't legally do that. But you know what the king said? Too bad. He sent Parliament home And he would not call him again for the next 11 years. And in doing so, he would commit an act of hubris that would result in his own demise. Questions? All right, then we're done. Now, don't forget, we have no class on Thursday because it's Easter break. So if you are traveling home, have a wonderful Easter. Enjoy your time, not like you weren't just there with spring break, but enjoy your time with the family. Eat lots of food, charge your batteries, and come on back. We'll see you in a week.
Oh, one other thing, papers, papers, papers. The last day to get early submission bonus, ironically, is Easter. That's the last day of the month. So if you're almost done with the paper and you want to get a few extra points, drop it off in the engage box. But before you do it, make sure you check proflamanic.com. Sydney, make sure you don't get any silly mistakes. Follow all the directions on the paper. Yeah. Okay. I'm kind of, there was like a couple of other people paying attention, so. You asked about the paper, so I'll just use these examples.